Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the two front runners in the fight for the White House solidify their positions. North Korea announces a date for a rare Workers' Party Congress. World press freedom hits a 10-year low, according to a watchdog report. And we chat with our pop music expert about Prince.
His accomplishments are quite vast. When you talk about 39 albums and over 100 million record sales since he started when he was only 19.
It's right here on The Voice of America. New York businessman Donald Trump, in his race for the Republican Party's presidential nomination, had decisive victories in five state primary elections Tuesday: Delaware, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, and Rhode Island.
I just want to tell you, for the five states, I am so honored. This was, to me, our biggest night because it shows such diversity.
Trump, who now has about three-quarters the 1,237 delegates needed to secure the party nomination in Cleveland in July. He told supporters the race against Ohio Governor John Kasich and Texas Senator Ted Cruz is over. On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton solidified her lead over lone rival Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders with wins in four of the five states. She now has about 90% of the 2,383 delegates required. Clinton is already looking ahead to the general election campaign.
Let's go forward. Let's win the nomination. And in July, let's return as a unified party. Thank you all so much.
Sanders vowed to stay in the race right through the California primary election June 7th. Jeffrey Skelling, associate director of the Sabato Crystal Ball website of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, told VOA's Victor Beatty, Trump's opinion notwithstanding, the Republican race likely won't be decided until California.
Definitely a comprehensive win for Trump. And I think really what sums it up is that of the two candidates remaining on the Republican side challenging Trump, the only one who really could have played at all in this part of the country was John Kasich. But the problem for the anti-Trump forces is that John Kasich has no resources left practically and was not really in a position to truly challenge Trump. And Ted Cruz, the remaining anti-Trump candidate who has some resources, could never play in that part of the country.
This battle now goes to key states of Indiana and California. Apparently, that's where some people believe this nomination will ultimately be decided.
Absolutely. Indiana and California are the two most pivotal states remaining in the race. Trump needs to win statewide in Indiana. If he does that, he will carry, you know, a majority of the congressional districts there, and that would put him on a path where he could definitely get to 1,237 delegates. Meanwhile, Cruz were to win statewide there, and you have to remember, Indiana is going to be the only contest going on May 3rd, and it's going to be a rallying point for the anti-Trump forces. They're going to throw a ton of money into this. It's going to be very much like Wisconsin in that way, though I stress that Indiana is definitely a different state from Wisconsin. I think it's too easy to lump them together. They are definitely different states. The southern part of Indiana has some Appalachian influences, which are areas that Trump has done very well in. He's won almost every county in Appalachia that's voted so far. And there's also the Gary, Indiana area, the northwest corner of the state that Trump should do well in as well. So really, you know, it's setting up to be a relatively competitive state. And, you know, a comparison would be Missouri, where Trump won by a couple points. If Cruz can win there, that will make it very difficult for Trump to get to 1,237 delegates without the help from unbound delegates, which so far his campaign has not shown a great ability to wrangle.
Briefly on the Democratic side, there seem to be signs from the Sanders campaign that this may have been a pivotal turning point for that effort to unseat Hillary Clinton from the nomination.
Well, the loss in New York was unquestionably, you know, bad for Sanders. He'd had a pretty good run of contests, but further showing that momentum has not really been much of a factor in this election campaign. It meant very little in the end in New York, where he lost soundly, and Clinton very quickly made up any of the delegate margin she had lost over the last few weeks. So Clinton's lead is basically insurmountable at this point.
Sanders conceded to the Associated Press he has a very, very narrow path to the nomination and will have to win some big victories. The next contest for both parties is Indiana, May 3rd. J. Joining me here at the anchor desk is our social media reporter, Andrew Palchewski, and he's got more on what's going on the web and Twitter and Facebook and all those things concerning the U.S. politics story. And welcome, Andrew. As always, nice to have you.
Good to be here. Thank you so much. Well, it's interesting to look at how the candidates are taking this election last night and spinning it on social media and using the different social media platforms. So we have, for example, Donald Trump on Facebook, and he writes this, you know, 4 or 5 paragraph long post where he says, together we're going to keep this momentum going, we're going to continue. He's, you know, kind of trying to rile up his supporters. Whereas on Twitter, he just sent out these very brief kind of tweets, says, thank you, Rhode Island, thank you, Connecticut, thank you, Maryland, thank you, Delaware, thank you, Pennsylvania. Each individual tweet for each individual state with some little graphic that they've made up, and then one that just says, thank you, America. So it's little, you know, short digestible bites on Twitter versus this kind of longer speech-like post on Facebook. Kasich and Cruz are kind of silent on social media. They're kind of saying they're going to keep fighting. Kasich on social media said he's going to push forward. Cruz is looking to Indiana. In fact, he put up a clip of his speech last night in Indiana. He's not even in any of the states that held primaries yesterday. He was in Indiana looking forward to that contest on May 3rd and is already pushing that out on social media to focus on that. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton put up video clips on her Twitter and Facebook pages. She says on Facebook, imagine a tomorrow where hard work is honored, families are supported, communities are strong. And this is the line that I think she, you know, kind of the double entendre, love Trump's hate. That's a line that she's used several times, yes, using, you know, love trumping hate to get that Donald Trump kind of name in there. Bernie Sanders on his social media says he's going to keep vowing to fight forward and push forward, although he admits that it's going to be a tough path to get to the nomination. But he continues to vow to fight on and will continue to fight until June when we go to California.
And I'm sure they'll continue to use that social media to every advantage they can.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA reports that its exoplanet-finding Kepler spacecraft has recovered from a recent bout of problems and has resumed its mission of looking for extrasolar planets. On April 7th, while Kepler team members were making a scheduled contact with the spacecraft, they noticed that it was operating in emergency mode, its lowest operational level. Mission officials say that the spacecraft probably went into emergency mode about 36 hours prior to its discovery. According to NASA, mission operators have since put Kepler through a series of procedures to take it out of emergency mode and normalize its operations. Among those procedures included reloading Kepler's computer data and turning the spacecraft so that its telescope points to the center of the Milky Way. This orientation allows Kepler to continue making its observations and looking for planets beyond our own solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
North Korea announced today it will convene its 7th Workers' Party Congress May 6th, the first in nearly 40 years. It is likely to confirm the rule and policy goals of leader Kim Jong-un, who took power from his late father in 2011. The announcement, highly anticipated for weeks, comes as the world prepares for a possible 5th nuclear test by the North. President Obama Tuesday warned the United States might consider other options if Pyongyang continues to conduct nuclear and ballistic missile tests, which violate international resolutions. Mr. Obama appeared in a CBS Television Network news interview.
North Korea is a massive challenge. Our first priority is to protect the American people and our allies, Republic of Korea, Japan, that are vulnerable to the provocative actions that North Korea is engaging in. They are erratic enough, their leader is personally irresponsible enough, that we don't want them getting close. But it's not something that lends itself to an easy solution.
Washington repeated its call on the North to refrain from actions that destabilize the region and take concrete steps to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. We asked Stanford University Korea analyst David Straub why the date of the party Congress had been kept secret up to now.
They do this to maintain internal control, and I think probably some of their bureaucracy feels that it's a security measure against possible external sabotage. This is the first such Congress since 1980. I believe that that Congress lasted 4 days. I would expect this one to last at least a few days.
Why such a long interval between a Congress?
Well, essentially because North Korea is a dictatorship, and they only have pretend parliamentary conclaves occasionally for the show. This one is going to be to confirm Kim Jong-un as the complete successor to his grandfather and father in all leadership positions. In fact, the one in 1980 also played an important role in making his father de facto leader at the time.
What do we expect the Congress to discuss?
Officials all over the world, but especially in the United States and South Korea, are going to be watching to see if there are any policy directions and any personnel changes that might signify different directions in North Korea. Many analysts, especially on the left, are suggesting that Kim Jong-un may say that now, because they have a so-called nuclear deterrent, they can and will focus on economic development. I believe that's a possibility, but in fact, the North Koreans have often said they were going to focus again on economic development, and they never really have, because their real focus is on maintaining domestic stability and maintaining the military.
We asked about the possibility of North Korea conducting a fifth nuclear test.
The North Koreans' entire intent is to show the world that sanctions don't work against them, and therefore the rest of the world has to accommodate itself to North Korea being a nuclear weapons state. They're delusional. That simply is not going to happen. But for the moment, they continue to believe that it's possible if they just hang in there tough. So it is quite possible that they'll conduct another nuclear or a long-range missile test ahead of this event. If they do, I believe the UN Security Council will meet again and impose even tougher sanctions than they did recently.
David Straub says the issue will likely take some years to resolve. Coming up on International Edition, press freedom is reported taking a big dip, and the many talents of Prince. Freedom of the press declined across the globe last year to its lowest point in more than a decade, according to a Washington watchdog group. Freedom House, in a new report, says only 1 in 7 people in the world lives in a nation where coverage of political news is robust, journalist safety is considered, and there is minimal amount of state intrusion. VOA's Ken Bredemeyer spoke with the report's research director, Jennifer Dunham.
This year, we found in our Freedom of the Press 2016 report that there were 12 consecutive, it's the 12th consecutive year of decline in press freedom around the world. And the number of people living in a free country with a free press reached its lowest level in more than a decade. We found that only 13% of the world's population lives in a country with a free press. And there are a couple primary reasons for the declines that we're seeing. One is the heightened level of violence against journalists around the world in various settings. And another primary reason is kind of the heightened level of polarization or partisanship in several different types of media environments. And by that I mean journalists are pressured to take one side or the other, either by politicians, powerful media owners, or armed insurgent groups.
This heightened partisanship, it's more not in the sense that Americans would think about partisanship, right? But partisanship in the sense of you're fighting with us or you're fighting against us, if you're not, is that right?
Well, I think the example of the American media is a mild example of this phenomenon. We see the, especially with the presidential race, the media has become especially partisan on one side or the other, Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal. But in a country, for example, in Egypt, we see that the regime of President Sisi is putting a lot of pressure on journalists to report favorably about the government and against the Muslim Brotherhood, so much so that it's practically stamped out any dissenting voices, and even in the state and private media, all are really putting forth a pro-Sisi narrative. And so that's really one of the more extreme examples of that phenomenon.
And that partisanship and polarization then leads to the taking of extra-legal intimidation and physical violence that you cite in the report. How has that played out in the world's worst trouble spots, say the Middle East, where terrorists hold control and a good part of the territory? And what does that mean in terms of the treatment of journalists?
I'm not sure if the partisanship and polarization are exactly related to the violence, though it can be in some ways. You know, in Syria and Iraq, we do see just reporters having to risk their lives to get any type of news whatsoever. And, you know, Syria was the place with the highest number of journalist deaths in 2015. So we do see a high level of violence against journalists in conflict zones, also Libya, Yemen, those type of places, so much so that it's really hard to get information in some places.
Jennifer Dunham with Freedom House. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Strokes are a common cause of disability. They happen when blood and vessels in the brain leaks out or blood flow is blocked. University of Oxford researchers are looking at the possibility that electrical stimulation could be a benefit to recovering stroke patients for reasons that are not yet fully understood.
What we think it does is just allow the brain cells to fire just a little bit more.
That's Dr. Charlotte Stagg at Oxford. She says that stroke patients who received electrical stimulations called transcranial direct current stimulation showed better improvements at manual tasks than those who just received physiotherapy.
What we think stimulation does is just increase the rate at which those cells are firing, and so speed up the learning of that new skill.
Strokes affect some 17 million people worldwide every year. Millions die from stroke, and it's the most common cause of disability in the West. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Fans have been streaming past the large impromptu memorial outside Prince's home and studio near Minneapolis. The music icon died suddenly at the age of 57, shocking and saddening music lovers worldwide. We haven't had a chance to speak since then with our pop music expert, Larry London. But now the host of Border Crossings joins us here in the studio. Thanks for being here, Larry.
Thank you, Susan. Yes, what a sad, sad time it is.
Yes, yes, yes. Prince was so big, it's kind of silly for me to even ask about his legacy, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Okay.
What's his legacy?
What's his legacy? Well, that's yet to be determined exactly what his legacy is, but I know that his accomplishments are quite vast. When you talk about 39 albums and over 100 million record sales since he started when he was only 19 and signed to a contract in 1977, the man has collected 7 Grammys and an Oscar. And not only that, touched a lot of lives as a producer and as a songwriter. He was an icon in many respects, not only for fashion, for show business and entertainment, but he was great for what he stood for as well, because you may recall back in about 93, he stopped calling himself Prince and chose to go by an artist formerly known as Prince, and he used the love symbol, the gender for men and women combined, that was his symbol at the time, and he'd perform with a tattoo on his face, the writing that said slave, and that was his representation of his disenchantment and dissatisfaction with the music industry as a whole at that time.
Because he wanted to do his own thing.
Not only him. He just didn't like artists in general being controlled and being stifled, not only monetarily, but also creatively as well in the whole process. So that was his way of reflecting and making his statement. But in 2000, he returned to the name Prince again, which wasn't his real name, Sir Rogers Nelson. And it's interesting that his father, John, and mother, Maddie, they were in music. He grew up in a music household, a jazz family. But his dad, John, used to use the name Prince when he performed. So that's where Prince took the name.
Oh, I didn't know
Prince.
That.
Yes, and Prince was known as Skipper when he was growing
up. It doesn't have the same ring. Skipper and Prince doesn't have the same kind of ring.
Exactly. Now, since his death last week, his record sales have increased exponentially. Millions and millions of sales and downloads, and I imagine that will continue to be the case.
One of the things that amazed me about him is he could play so many instruments, from the guitar to the drums, which is really a very different area.
Do you know how many he played?
How many?
20.
Sheesh.
He knew 20 instruments by age 12.
Wow. Wow, so, it was amazing. Yeah. And he could dance.
Yes, he could.
And he was definitely a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a style. And he helped his community.
Yes.
He had everybody into those concerts in his state there.
That's right. Paisley Park Studios is Paisley Park Home, which is the name of it. There are those people that say that it's going to be turned into a museum to honor his memory. But yes, you're right. He hosted many parties. He had rules at his house. If you wanted to come to his party, no profanity, no drugs, which is unlike, you know, what goes on in the music world, a showbiz world these days. So he, you know, he might have lived a very erotic kind of life. He was a ladies' man, but nonetheless, he wanted to be a good role model, and that he was. And a lot of people didn't realize this. He was married twice, and his wife, I believe it was his first wife, had a baby that only lived 7 days. And he had talked about, in the very few rare instances where he would speak publicly about his private life, he said that that affected him deeply.
Yes.
And it still affected him to the very end.
Well, let's listen to one of his most popular, actually the most popular song, Purple Rain. And I thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Well, thank you, Susan.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Vietnam are deepening and broadening their ties in many areas. In a speech to university students in Vietnam, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about the culture required for entrepreneurship to flourish and how all nations and citizens share a stake in cultivating and upholding such a culture. In order for Vietnam to become a leader in technology and innovation, it must encourage an educational system that promotes critical thinking, creativity, and experimentation. Moreover, entrepreneurship and innovation thrive in a policy environment that promotes growth through transparency, the rule of law, the protection of intellectual property, and predictable regulations that enable all companies to compete on a level playing field. The task at hand is for Vietnam to consolidate its 2 decades of tremendous economic gains. An important means of doing that is through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of which Vietnam is an original signatory. The TPP is a trade agreement that will bring 40% of the global economy together behind the highest labor, environment, and intellectual property protections in the world. Another central ingredient to Vietnam's economic success is respect for human rights. A vibrant culture of entrepreneurship, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, is almost unimaginable without a foundation of rights and freedoms upon which citizens feel able to pursue their ambitions, express their opinions, and bring their ideas to life. The U.S. urges the government of Vietnam to release all political prisoners and cease harassment, arrests, and prosecutions of journalists, bloggers, civil society activists, or students for exercising their fundamental rights. And finally, Vietnam, as part of the global economy, has a growing responsibility to participate, along with the U.S. and others, in efforts to tackle issues from international peacekeeping to wildlife trafficking to maritime security, from climate change to civil nuclear energy to global health. The United States looks forward to continuing to expand its partnership with Vietnam.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.